This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Maria is a PhD candidate in sociology at the New School for Social Research, and her academic work focuses on the relationship between material culture and politics, and she's currently exploring the connections between fashion design and the political discourses and practices of domination in socialist Cuba. And in fact, there's a very interesting timeline of fashion in Cuba that is above that clothes rack there that she's put together for the evening. She's a collector of Cuban material culture. This is a tiny part of her collection, which was also on display at the New School recently. And
October 17, November 1st.
Till November 1st.
Yes.
Okay, so. And that's at the Parsons.
September 17th, October 1st.
October 17th and November 1st.
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
and that is where exactly, Maria?
September 17th,
oh,
no,
September.
October 1st.
Sorry. Oh, so we missed it.
Yes.
Ah, we missed it.
But it was a different exhibition.
Scratch that. It was great.
But there are some images on the website.
There's some images on the website. I'll just parrot whatever she says. Maria is also a collector of Cuban material culture from the Cold War era, and she's the co-editor of the Souvenirs column of the journal Cuba Counterpoints, which is probably familiar to a lot of you. I've never heard of it, and it's very interesting. I've been looking at it. Jackie Voss is professor of Spanish and Comparative Literature and Cultural Studies at the University of Connecticut. She's the author of Dreaming in Russian, the Cuban-Soviet Imagery, that came out in 2013, and Cosmopolitan's Cosmopolitanisms in Latin America Against the Destiny of Place in 2005, and co-editor was Jose Manuel Prieto of Caviar with Rum, Cuba, USSR, and the Post-Soviet Experience that came out in 2012, and with Esther Whitfield of New Short Fiction from Cuba that came out from Northwestern University Press in 2007. In addition to working on the Phenotype Project she's going to present tonight, she also edits the translation section of the same excellent journal, Cuba Counterpoints. Jaira Alfonso is a graduate of Havana's Higher Institute of Art, and he has the wonderful large frame piece just behind that wall. And his work, he works with many different media, and his work has been shown in a lot of different places. Most recently, Flow, Economies of the Look and Creativity in Contemporary Art from the Caribbean in Washington, D.C., the IDB Cultural Center. I don't know anything about Gandry Pavon. This was not on the... This was a late edition, so you'll have to...
It's my fault.
Do that bio. So thank you for coming, and please join me in welcoming Maria and Jackie.
I'm sorry, Yandy, but Yandy has a wonderful website that you can Google and find a lot about his work and his bio. And thank you, Sina, for and Cabinet for hosting this exhibition and talk, and Jackie for co-curating the exhibition with me and sharing the table as well. I want also to thank Kashita Brantes, who is the founder and former director of La Maison Fashion House in Havana, for lending me her fashion catalogs and clothing, and to all of you for being here tonight. Belarusian author Svetlana Alexievich, this year Nobel's laureate in literature, once said that the state socialist regimes of Eastern Europe and the USSR did not collapse due to Ronald Reagan's or Margaret Thatcher's politics, but rather because citizens were tired of the way communism affected their daily life. In Cuba, however, where daily life had many resemblances with Eastern Europe and the USSR, the regime did not collapse in 1989 or afterwards. This fact has not motivated Cuban or Eastern European political scientists, sociologists, or anthropologists to pay attention to the material culture of Cuban socialism, despite the fact that more than a generation of scholars and writers have tried to understand socialism collapse in Eastern Europe, examining the politics of material culture, Cuba has not been included in this analysis or study as a particular anomalous case. As a result, the academic community has only provided partial hypotheses to the role that material culture played in the Velvet Revolution and incomplete answers to why, when the Berlin Wall was smashed down, Cubans were reading the phenomenal results of the last potato harvest in the national newspaper's front page. this was the panorama I found when I began thinking about my dissertation project back in 2012. I decided then to study the relationship between politics and material culture in Cuban socialism during the three decades of state socialism and Cold War that anteceded the disintegration of the Soviet bloc, and contrast this material culture with the frame of reference of the material culture studies of Eastern Europe and the USSR. My research focuses on the study of the politics of Cuban socialist fashion, assessing the impact that pre-socialist, contemporary capitalist, and makeshift material cultures and their interaction with each other and with the fashion promoted by the state had in the political structures and discourses of Cuban socialism. It is in this ecumenical material order where multiple references coexisted, countered, and complemented each other where I found an important element of political legitimation and critique in socialist Cuba. As fashion became here in Cuba, and in the period that I studied prior to the collapse of the USSR, due to the lack of access to the public sphere and a locus where private identities were articulated both against and in harmony with the state-promoted values. Grosso modo, the fashion of this era was based on basic, unrefined, and coarse, and also highly uniform garments. This image that you see here shows the finalists of a beauty pageant all dressed in the same war cloth. And by the way, the shirt that they wearing is exhibited in the rack in here. In 1963, a ration card for industrial products was implemented, the Ministry of Domestic Commerce determining yearly quotas of basic clothing that greatly reduced the repertoire of garments available and homogenized outfits. Records show that in 1989, a girl's quota consisted of 1 meter of quality A, I suppose that's the best quality, fabric, 1.5 meters of quality B fabric, 1 uniform skirt, and 1 uniform blouse, 1 panty, 1 work pant, and 1 work shirt. That's it for a year. A boy's 1989 quota consisted of 1 shirt produced in 1988 or afterwards, 1 meter of quality A fabric, 1.5 meters of quality B fabric, 1 pant or short produced in 1988 or after, 1 uniform pant and 1 uniform shirt, 1 regular cotton underwear produced in 1987 and 1 knitted cotton underwear, 1 work pant and 1 work shirt. That's it. However, zooming into, this is what was provided for everybody. Zooming into the fashion of the period, it's possible to find fashion discourses and practices that counter this major narrative of proletarian egalitarianism. Those counter-narratives deliver a promise of modernization and improved standards of living, and for that, modern, fashionable clothes were available to selected groups of citizens. In 1960, a program created to educate teenagers from Havana shantytowns also taught pupils how to dress in a fashionable way. A former administrator recalls, "Every month, we had a quinceañero party. We prepared very cute clothes for the birthday girls and their accessories. For the first time in their life, they put on high heels, stockings. All this gave the parents extraordinary joy because we gave their daughters all the things they could not give them." This is not just a case of a program conceived as part of redistributive policies, but also of a greatly symbolical strategy that communicated the real possibilities to get access to a modern life that the revolution and socialism would bring even to these disadvantaged sectors. The capacity of socialism as a system to provide fashionable clothing was also communicated through the production of fashion prototypes and ideas catered to the urban middle class sectors. For this, in 1964, the state created the Bureau of Fashion Orientation, and the following year, the experimental atelier La Rampa. La Rampa is a very centric area in Havana. These hubs produce modern, fashionable clothing proposals for the consumption of fashion-conscious and, above all, well-connected Havana dwellers. The Bureau circulated fashion sketches, prototypes, and in the best case, and only in the best cases, and this was very rare, small batches of clothing catered to the cultural public of Havana. These proposals, inspired in capitalist fashion styles, almost never reached the industry or the national circuit of retail stores, however. The creation of these institutions, as well as their fashion products or ideas, can be understood as part of a representational fashion narrative. This term, representational, was coined by socialist fashion historian Georgia Bartlett to define a fashion produced in the Soviet Union and the Eastern European People's Republics that was not available in stores for people to consume, but instead was intended to represent a prosperity and modernity that did not exist in reality, and this fashion only existed in magazines and the store windows. In Cuba, the symbolic use of fashion can be traced back to the representational use of fashion can be traced back to the first days of instauration of the revolutionary power. However, this production of representational fashion took momentum in the 1970s and 80s after the failure of the undertaken strenuous sacrifices and the imposed material deprivations of the 1960s. The state opted for momentarily abandoning its exclusive emphasis on moral rewards, providing instead some real opportunities to consume, aimed at restoring people's enthusiasm in the political project. Promises of consumerism accompanied the celebration of the first Congress of the Cuban Communist Party in 1975. José Lobio Menéndez, at the time a state cadre, writes in his memoir that Havana stores were, I'm quoting, suddenly stocked with imported clothing, electrical equipment, and cosmetics, end of quote, sold through the non-ration market at prices higher than those of the articles on the ration card. We are exhibiting most of these articles here, too. Scholars of Stalinism and Eastern European socialism have outlined a similar tendency in the mid-30s in the USSR and during the post-war period in the rest of the bloc, which they explain as the result of a tacit deal by means of which the state socialist regimes allow the elites to enjoy higher living standards and some of the trappings of bourgeois life in exchange for political loyalty and participation in the socialist project. Previously, going back to Cuba, in 1971, the state had opened a chain of stores called Casas de los Regalos, or gift houses, which are the Janus phase of the rationing system. This chain of stores, and later in the 1980s, those of the officially named parallel market, and it was called parallel because it was parallel to the ration market, sold a variety of higher quality goods at prices also higher than those of the ration market, while supplies lasted, and they lasted for a little brief period of time. So most people didn't get access to them. In the 1980s, the parallel market absorbed about 20% of individual incomes, surpassing by 10% the volume of sales of the ration market in 1983. ECODI, this is the name of the state agency of market research in Cuba, identified five different consumer profiles in 1986. They were the avant-gardist, the indifferent, the conservative, the advanced, and the late comer. Only avant-gardists and late comers consumed regularly at the parallel market, both groups being characterized by high wage and high levels of schooling, also having in common that they live in urban centers. Yet avant-gardists and latecomers also had comparatively higher levels of clothes privately sewn or from foreign origin, including shoes, with the difference that avant-gardists were considerably younger, lived principally in Havana, where about half of the sales of the parallel market were concentrated, and were dissatisfied with the amount and quality of the clothing and shoes they owned. Latecomers, older than avant-gardists, were, on the contrary, quite satisfied with their clothing. Urban, better remunerated consumers, this study concluded, preferred to acquire their clothes in the parallel market, looking for markers of distinction that oppose current egalitarian discourses. ECO studies confirmed that the 1970s and 80s commercial policies affected an increase in the differences between urban and rural zones in terms of clothing ownership. If in 1974 urban dwellers had an average of 5 clothing items more than rural dwellers, in 1987 the difference had augmented to 13, and this was a lot in the 1980s in Cuba. In other words, in 1987, rural dwellers had an average of clothing ownership comparable to that reported for urban dwellers in 1978. As a result, in spite of rural dwellers aspiring to possess less things than urban dwellers, their dissatisfaction was higher. These differences between urban and rural zones are similar to those between income brackets. ECR studies on footwear ownership also revealed that low-income groups own 3.84 pairs of shoes per capita as compared with middle-income groups, which own 4.85 pairs, and high-income groups owning 6.12 pairs per capita. As a consequence, consumer satisfaction varied among these groups. Low-income consumers, showing the lowest level, 38% of satisfaction, followed by middle-income and high-income groups, 48% and 57%, respectively. The parallel market, as we can see, created visible social differences that separated the professional classes and the highest income groups in the capital city from the rest of the country, giving shape to a meritocratic elite and legitimizing markers of distinction and inequality that favor educated and the overproductive citizens. However, only 27% of the sales of the parallel market corresponded to industrial mass consumer goods. The rest was related with the sale of foodstuff, tobacco, or alcohol, which indicates that Cuban consumers continued acquiring their clothes and footwear mainly through the ration market. The fashion house La Maison, and we have a very fashionable and elaborate dress exhibited, and some fashion brochures as well, associated with the fashion venture context, founded in 1977 by Cachita Brantes, constitutes a different kind of project that can also be defined as representational, mostly oriented to the foreign market. And this is the main difference between the rest of the strategies I've been talking about. La Maison combines representational discourses with nationalistic narratives and petit bourgeois conceptions of elegance, which you can appreciate in the pictures here exhibited on top of the vitrines. I have no time to discuss all the narratives articulated here, but nor the impact that this relatively small fashion house had in Havana cultural scene and in the permanent production of markers and spaces of distinction for Havana's political and cultural elites. I will just mention the effective articulation of nationalistic and elitist discourses, as a result of which attractive and highly elaborated garments and fashion shows were produced. Okay. This can be better appreciated in the evolution of the Guayabera shirt. Throughout the 60s, the new regime promoted the use of this garment as a means to convey the identification of the state with the rural and popular sectors and its anti-elitist stance, as well as the authenticity of the Cuban socialism as compared with the Soviet socialism. Note also that prior to the Cuban Revolution, the use of the Guayabera shirt, even though it was popular, had been criticized by Havana's upper classes. New brands of guayabera appeared in the 60s that stressed nationalism, like criolla, meaning creole. This garment also represented, in the 1960s, the unity of Cuban people, like the guayabera, and as such was declared by Fidel Castro during the peasants' gathering organized in Havana in July 1959. Everybody was dressed with the guayabera, and that meant that the pueblo, the people of Cuba, had only one common interest, and all were united in supporting Castro. In the late 70s, this masculine garment was restyled as a women's and children's clothing, produced by Contex, popularized in shorts, women's blouses, and children's jumpsuits. Soon, La Maison also began to produce highly sophisticated guayabera dresses, like the one exhibited here, courtesy of Cachita Brantes, that helped to promote the Cuban regime abroad. These images that I'm going to show now, also courtesy of Cachita Brantes, show foreign celebrities enjoying the best of Cuban fashion in different events celebrated at La Maison. And I'm going to pass quickly through these images, and I named the celebrities that all the votes are events at La Maison. We had the Rockefeller family, Gregory Peck, and all those are in the 1980s, before 1989.
Well, they were in
the Rivera's tour. No. They. You're going to see. So, Julie Belafonte, Emilio Pucci, which is a famous fashion designer, and Nati Abascal wearing a Guayabera shirt, a dress. Finally, I want to add that as part of my research, in 2012, I created the blog Cuba Material, which some of you know already, where I've been archiving information on Cuban material culture. Soon, I began collecting artifacts from the Cold War period in Cuba, a small part of which is exhibited here, as Sina said. Jacqueline and I curated the selection with the intention to convey the material culture in which current notions of fino, only partially understood as refining and good taste, and I'm saying only partially because Jack is going to explain later, took shape in Cuba. The objects exhibited are important, and this is what brought Jacqueline and I here today, and probably many of you as well, to better understand the contemporary Cubans, those that will vote someday a new president or will continue searching to emigrate to the United States. Thank you.
Personal project, and so it creates some humor. And I'll talk about that as well. So anyway, from refinement, purity, education, spiritual goodness and generosity, and glamour, to other characteristics like homosexuality, sexual repression, and whiteness. Through going beyond the immediate realm of interview with Juan Carlos Salom in the trailer to this documentary that we're working on, into the global Cuban cultural panorama, and I'm using global here in the way that Jose Quiroga does to make clear that this account is not limited to the island. This analysis is nourished by the Phenotype Project that I am launching, an interactive site with links to the trailer that you just saw and to photographs and archives that I'm curating. And I wanted to, on this website, I will be soliciting the participation of a public, asking them to send in short videos, texts, songs, images, and the likes, answering the same question that I asked in the interview, and I'll show you this trailer. I forgot to show you the trailer, right? But I'll do that right now. What does fino, finura, and finesa mean to them? To comment on the images in the current gallery and archives, expanding upon the gallery and the archives as well. So let's look at the trailer. This trailer was filmed by Juan Carlos Salom, who I don't think is here right now, and edited by Ernesto René Rodriguez, who is actually here. And here we go. It's very quick, and it goes quite quickly. Shall we?
¿Qué es lo fino? ¿Nosotros?
¡Bien! ¡Se subieron los finos al camión!
¿Y sabes lo que la frase que ella me decía? Me decía, tan fina que te haces, negra, y te equivocas.
Mucha gente dice, él es fino, ¿no? O se usa fino. Es un síntoma de que la palabra fino, ahora en Cuba, significa también hacerse el fino.
Guabina, que yo no quiero que tú te vayas con esa gente de mangla.
Yo no creo que yo era burguesía, pero yo creo que yo era aristocrática. La antigüedad era más importante que el dinero. O sea, mi familia llegó a Cuba en 1500. Eso era más importante que el dinero que teníamos.
El refinamiento es una especie de entrega.
La Virgen de la Caridad del Cobre, donde en ese símbolo está recogido todo lo mejor del espíritu, de la, del más fino espíritu de la nacionalidad cubana.
Si la revolución se plantea a sí misma y se entiende a sí misma como un proceso que va a invertir, que va a virar de cabeza toda la estructura social e histórica, entonces viran de cabeza también el gusto.
A mí no me gustan los hombres finos. Los hombres finos son flojitos. A mí me gustan los hombres que hablen fuerte para yo entenderlo bien.
Los varones sí, las niñas no.
Si un hombre no es refinado, es tosco o grosero en la cultura nuestra.
Tipo cara de cielo. Tenía como toda una tendencia natural a apropiarse de la belleza.
Para ser fino no puedes soltar cualquier cosa que te pase por la cabeza.
O sea, las pieles más finas son las pieles más trabajadas, las pieles que han pasado por procesos para hacerlas más suaves, para hacerlas, eso es. Y por eso, y hay el valor de tener que procesar y trabajar más. La maquinaria inventada por el hombre, quien le da el valor a ese producto terminado.
Mira, estaba aquí de casualidad. Uno puede ser fino después de haber comido 10, 15, 20 años. De verdad. Esta me la trajeron de allá. Mira, toda.
This project, thinking about Fino, was very much inspired by him, by our, in the sense of my thinking about my dear friend Armando Suarez Covian, and the meaning of that word. Also, it's a very personal concept for me in my own life, and thinking about what how refinement and that's a very brief definition carved out, you know, my identity. So anyway, so in this way, I hope, I'm going back to the paper here, I hope that we may come to terms with the significance. Actually, you know what I wanted to show you before I actually wanted to go there, because I mentioned to you these archives that are expanding and this Fino Gallery. And these are, when we're interviewing the different subjects, I always ask, you know, what is Fino to you? And what is the concept of Fino based? We say, is there something in your environment that's right around you that you envision as Fino? So I selected statements, and generally, mostly I selected statements from the interviews that correspond to the object or the person, all of which were also photographed by Juan Carlos Alom. And so here we have a description of Limoges porcelain. And Limoges porcelain Mayer was considered the most fina porcelain in the past. Someone might have commented and said, "Oh, look, that piece, those pieces, it's made of porcelain." I see it. Yeah, that piece, a typo there. It's made of Limoges porcelain, and people would have said, "Oh, it's Limoges porcelain." Okay. And Maria Antonieta Julieta was Maria Antonieta Julia was gracious enough to speak with us on several occasions. And extensive-ish interviews with her about what Fino was. Or we have this rice with Armando Suarez Covian. So for me, fineza is not necessarily a physical stereotype, but rather an aesthetic stereotype. The spirit is what defines or sculpts in a person one's manners, how one projects oneself, how one behaves. So that gallery is expanding, and I'm hoping that people actually comment on the images as well in that gallery and also in the archives. At this point, the archives, I'll talk about them. So anyway, I'll leave you. In this way, I hope as we may come to terms with the significance of the slippery category, that like the similarly slippery vernacular aesthetic categories elucidated by Sian Nye, she talks about the zany, the cute, and the interesting, They cannot be entirely constrained by the kind of historicism characteristics of the last three or so decades of literary and cultural studies. Glancing momentarily at some of the images from our archive section of the website, we can infer echoes with the content of Maria Antonia's sociological analysis of revolutionary consumption that stakes out a place for both high culture and Western consumption alongside the universal dictates of socialist functionality. With regard to our archive section that at this time draws from numerous issues of Muchachas magazine of the mid-1980s and seeks to begin to discern the revolution's relationship to the category of fino, fines and finura with regard to the education of young female adolescents, I wanted to emphasize the fact that at this moment that section is not organized in a definitively historical fashion, characteristic of other digital collections, but rather in the words of Susana Sevilla-Ho, my digital collaborator who's right here, its organization is more, in her words, analogous to that of a Pinterest board. This stylistic dimension is not meant to commodify or depoliticize the strategies of both repression and tolerance that molded revolutionary fashion, comportment, conduct, and the subject's complex relationship to finesa, or what César Chagall, the literary critic and comparatist known for his work on the great Cuban author Lesa Malima and Joyce, refers to as polites, but rather to easily identify how the topic of the fino overflows the very historical dimensions with which it interacts through the very creation of an expanding visual archive. It is my hope that as this project expands and becomes interactive, this section will extend back beyond the revolutionary period into the Republican and colonial times of Cuba. And in fact, I'm working with a group of students who are choosing images from the 19th century, for instance, images from tobacco boxes, that we're hoping to also include in these archives. In this way, we'll be able to assess visually distinct and repetitive variants of the fino across time spans and begin to perceive the productivity of engaging this category to explore the persistent legacies of class, race, and sexuality within the Cuban imaginary of different periods, and to extrapolate how this category exerts its force not only on the current aesthetic and ethical paradigms, but it also conditions how Cubans from the diaspora and on the island imagine a new Cuba, wherein the strategies of socialist consumption that Maria Antonia refers to may or may not fade into the distant past. Conspicuous and bifurcated consumption, while at an ever faster pace, is however nothing new unto itself. From the disintegration of the Soviet bloc onwards, Cubans have been increasingly confronted with the capitalist forms of consumption through the bifurcated economy, creating a situation in which, as Victor Fowler, the eminent Cuban cultural critic and current Momlin Fellow at Harvard's W.E.B. Du Bois Research Institute so aptly notes, the so-called day after for Cubans will be incomparable with the scenes of awe of Easterners when they came face to face back in 1989 with the Western store windows, because they've been dealing with this for many decades now. Phenotype is especially timely as Cubans in different geographical spaces rebuild emotional and economic ties to the island and begin to try to reclaim their citizenship and properties, and in so doing frequently assert narratives of pureness and legitimacy, where competing frameworks of class, race, and sexuality honed in capitalist and socialist societies come into play. Furthermore, the Cuban government's inability to sustain the state-sponsored economy and its consequent admission of entrepreneurship, along with the rapid onslaught of U.S. tourism, increase contemporary differentiation among classes and contribute to transforming Cubans' relationship to what they envision as fino. This category is, moreover, exemplary of a kind of complicated racial dynamics that took shape in the colonial and republican eras, characterized novels like classic novels like Cirilio Villaverde's 19th century Cecilia Valdez about the tragic love story between the legitimate mixed race and fina daughter of a land magnate slave trader and her brother. We also see it at the forefront of Fernando Ortiz's 1940 study, where tobacco and sugar are personified to expose the complex historical mechanisms around refinement, capitalism, and mass culture that emerged in colonial times and, as he suggests, penetrated Republican society. In talking about the spectacles of decency on television that characterized Batista's rule in the 1950s, in her recently published book, Broadcasting Modernity, Yeri Rivero reveals how the Batista's government sought to, quote-unquote, conceal aspects of Cuba's popular culture that challenged the perception of Cubans as white, Europe-oriented, Catholic, and sexually restrained people. And I would say for all those adjectives, one could practically substitute the single word fino. It has that many connotations. Anyway, Rivero follows the spectacles through the early years of the revolution to see the emergence of instances of popular culture alongside high art, so-called high art, as part of the process of reconstruction whereby, quote-unquote, items, practices, and cultural artifacts traditionally associated with the Cuban elite, from sophisticated clothing and hairstyles to the opera, ballet, and theater broadcast and television, were redefined, reframed, and reintroduced as within the reach of all Cubans. And I think, you know, this, that is to say, the images within, you know, the muchachas of our archives, or the clothing and accessories here today that Maria and Antonio and I have curated with the concept of Fino in mind, served to wink at the ways in which Fidel Castro and his government tried to shape the axis by which Cubans naturally identified with the West. While other Spanish speakers may use Fino and, albeit even, and they may use Finura and Finesa, the Cuban case is especially interesting because once in power, Fidel Castro, the legitimate son of a wealthy landowner and his mistress, sought to subsume marks of distinction in the Cuban people, viewed as threats to the nation under socialist definitions of equality, all while bringing high culture to the masses. Anti-bourgeois fervor pervaded the 1960s state paradigm, echoed in this famous 1965 letter by Che Guevara entitled Man and Socialism in Cuba, where he says, quoting Che Guevara, "The fault of many of our intellectuals and artists is to be found in their original sin. We can attempt to graft elm trees so that they bear pears, but at the same time, we must plant pear trees," end of quote. One of the more mundane results of his push to extirpate original sin or bourgeois values includes the tendency among those who grew up in revolutionary Cuba to reject saying thank you or please, words that were deemed to be part of the former bourgeois education. Distancing Cuban culture from that of capitalist society has meant the states implementing prescriptive measures that have included, throughout the 1960s and 80s, demonizing exiles, condemning and ideological diversionism, Cubans' preference for foreign styles in clothing or art in the 1970s, prohibiting quote-unquote vulgar reggaeton music in the 2000s, and shutting down two popular video game salons. This has been in recent years. Throughout these debates, what is Fino, if not front and center, lurks beneath the surface. The popular band Frijol Negro put Fino to the test with its 2004 song Super Finos Negros, a song whose lyrics called attention to the racist mentality of the phrase negro fino, or refined black. But as cultural critic and writer Odette Casamayor Cisneros, who's also here tonight, theorizes, the song is less about defiance than about refusing to yield to others' definitions. Used long before the revolution, this phrase, negro fino, and you know, many of our interviewees talk about that term, and I ask them about that term. In this trailer, it doesn't come out, it said front and center. But used long before this revolution, this phrase, negro fino, refers to the appearance of racial miscegenation and surprise regarding Afro-Cuban's degree of education. A negro fino, the phrase implies, behaves white. Being demasiado fino, or too fino, too much fino, on the other hand, can be an accusation of homosexuality or even, lest we say, bad taste, a category for which Cubans have a whole other series of words. Furthermore, it also presents a discourse between objective style and subjective judgment. What is objectively fino relates as much to the person doing the assessing as it does to the style of the object assessed. Evidently, not all of the answer to why students study Cubans and not other Spanish speakers of the Caribbean at this juncture, and there is definitely comparative work to be done, can be attributed entirely to the gradient of socialist state policy that sought to equalize through policy, problematizing marks of distinction, but also to a conversation around Cubanness and taste that pervades the 20th century, echoed in the following contemporary anecdote, conveyed to me by Sandra Ruiz, a Puerto Rican who studied with the recently deceased Cuban-American cultural critic, Jose Esteban Munoz, who himself worked through the critical nature of such terms as chusmeria. These are almost at the antipodes of fino, in classic books like Descendant y Disidentifications. According to Sandra, Jose told her, she lacked the Cuban finesse, what he translated to her as a mixture of grace and plasticity that could be especially effective. They debated as to whether this arguably particular Cuban trait could in fact be acquired, as it engaged with a degree of ephemerality to which the more mundane may not have access, even through capital. There is definitely a marked degree of play in this anecdote that speaks to the economies of work and free time that also reside in lo fino. Another echo of Muñoz's fascination with la finura can be seen in an article published last year by another of Muñoz's students, the Cuban-American Alexandra Vázquez, who is also here, who beautifully captures the erratic and ephemeral quality of fino in her analysis of the importance of manual labor in mid-20th century Miami for the eminent Cuban writer and artist Lydia Cabrera. Vázquez articulates, quote, "Her refuge of labored distraction in mid-century Cuba, of finding relief through adornment, which is, after all, a making different, indicates an enduring attention to the ornamentation of surfaces, sometimes known as Cuban finura," end of quote. And she goes on to briefly allude to how Cuban finura does not simply imitate the European, as many mistakenly assume, but rather speaks back to it, a topic that I'm hoping to push even further on. She states, "Inherited from a polycontinental sense of the Baroque, this embellishment of the at hand is but one example of Cabrera's lifelong attention to the minutiae that make everyday objects magical." End of quote. Inherited, exclusively, or acquirable is one of the topics that many of our interlocutors actually address in this emerging piece of work. Another relates to the peculiar difficulty of translating fino or finura and finesa into English. For when I take the easiest route and say refined, I'm already engaged in the process of repetition that is somewhat distant from the point of origin that characterizes much of Spanish speakers' thinking around what this adjective consists of, or noun. And for this reason, I chose not to translate the word within the documentary trailer. Finally, to that point, I'd like to conclude with a passage from Guillermo Cabrera's Infante's novel, Three Trapped Tigers, Tres Tristes Tigres, published originally in Spanish in 1967. Here, Cabrera Infante reflects upon the bohemian nightlife of 1950s, but its writerly gaze is as someone who has participated in the early years of the revolutions and feels that he has lost that world. I'm going to read it first in Spanish because for many reasons, and then in English, and I'll try to, and that's the end. So let me just read you this quote. Has anyone, well, Three Trapped Tigers is a magnificent book that I'm rereading all the time. And he says, the book, the characters, "Y miro y veo a las dos rubias paradas junto a nosotros, y lo que veo claro son dos batas de tul o de organdí, organza, me confirma una de las rubias después, cuando la bata estaba marchita, o de una tela muy delicada que abultan en cuatro bultos por sobre el alto, que es lo que tengo frente a mis ojos, cuando terminan los dos escotes morados, porque las dos están vestidas de malva y con modelos iguales. Veo el final o el comienzo de dos pechugas blancas lechosas, casi azuladas por la luz de tungsten, que están ahí arriba junto al pigal, y unos cuellos largos, no como de cisnes, sino como de unas yeguas blancas y finas y educadas, vienesas, vaya, y luego unas barbillas soberbias ensoberbecidas, porque saben que debajo llevan el cuello fino y largo y blanco, y el busto blanco y violeta que hace detener todas las miradas, las nuestras, las mías al menos, casi no salen de ahí. Antes de mirar las seguras maravillas que ahora oculta este caro imbécil, y después hay que seguir mirando hacia arriba unas bocas gordas y largas y rojas, largas en una sonrisa que no enseña todavía los dientes, porque sabe que la giaconda está otra vez de moda. Y las finas, lo siento, no tengo otro adjetivo por el momento. Narices, y Dios mío, aquellos cuatro ojos." Okay, so that's... I'm just going to get to the very... I'm not going to read the whole... Well, it's kind of a... The beginning, he starts describing the... Okay, I'll leave it. And I look up, and I see the double blonde who has stopped next to us, and naturally what I see are two gowns of tulle or organdy, organza, one of the blondes corrects me later on, when her gown is all creased up, but it sounded more like orgasm then, or some very delicate, durable, crispy material that becomes four bundles beyond the blue horizon of my car, which is what I will have right in front of my eyes, and where the two bloodless necklines come to a violet end. They are both dressed in purple. I see the beginning of two white bosoms, milky white, almost blue, like my car, which is also white, in the tungsten light of the street lamp end. Pay attention here. Two long necks, not swan-like, but two fine, white, and exactingly trained filis, lipizaner mares, as it were, and then two super haughty, superb chins, because they know that under them, their necks are fine and long and pearly white, and their busts so milky white, or rather violet-covered, that everybody stops to look at them, so do we. I, for one, could hardly take my eyes off them before looking at the other certain wonders which the dumb car of mine now keeps hidden. And then I must go upward on my journey, two broad red fleshy mouths, broad because the broads are smiling a smile which doesn't display their teeth, as they know Mona Lisa's back in town. And the fine. I'm sorry, fellers. I have no other adjective, not at this moment. Nostrils. And oh my God, those four eyes. actually, I wanted to. One more thing I was thinking about. Oh yeah, I wanted to just I wanted to show you. There's these sites of interest, and there's this artist that I'm, you know, been thinking about for a long time and writing about, who's has these quite fascinating series in relation to the Fino, which I'm hoping to incorporate even more sort of closely in thinking about these categories. And there's one section here which somehow isn't popping up, where I had them up before. Mm-hmm. That goes to the cuquitas. Well, that was interesting. She's in the one of them. Anyway, there's this whole series, and one of them is where they're looking at the pop-up kind of dolls that appear in magazines. And so she's working with a lot of the material culture that emerges in the conversations that I have, and certainly within this exhibition. And like Jairo Afonso's piece, which is also there, Jairo Afonso is here, and his piece is also on the wall, and Yandy Pavón's as well. So, but there are many artists that are sort of certainly maybe not aware of it or not aware, but are engaging with these different layers of material culture that are quite interesting. So,
and before. Going to the questions and answers, let me show quickly. Maybe I get that.
No.
I'm not that famous.
Your name?
Okay. Because this exhibition is not related, but it's like a second take of an exhibition I had, as Sina mentioned, at Parsons, the New School for Design. And I worked there with Yandy Pavón, was the invited artist. And I want to just read you Yandy's bio and show you the website of the exhibition. You can see also pictures of images of Cuba's material culture related with the War of Childhood from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But here, I'm gonna just read that. Yandy is a Cuban artist interested in the conceptual aura of ruins and decay, and in everyday practices of display and power, topics he has developed in his ruined paintings and wrinkled painting series. This series garnered him critical acclaim by the New York Times. Pavón also engaged issues of iconoclasm, totalitarianism, and ideology. Nemesis, one of his latest works, is a series of guerrilla projections of photographs of renowned dissident and political prisoners on the facades of the embassies and consulates representing their countries in the U.S. and Europe. Yandy's work has been featured in both individual and notable collective exhibitions. And just for you to know who Yandy is. Thank you.
Would you be open to questions, if there are questions?
Yeah.
Yes. And then we do a little walkthrough. Is that the best way to do it?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if you prefer me to answer or us to answer questions back in around the objects, or just answer here and then go back. I don't know.
As you wish. There's no template, so.
Okay. Whatever you prefer.
Maybe some questions here.
Yeah. Okay.
Walk over. Yes. are there questions? Yes.
First of all, thank you both. That was really fascinating. And my question is for Jackie. And I was wondering if any of the connotations, I don't know if it's really connotation or denotation of Fino emerged in the project. Like if there's anything that surprised you that was a kind of new valence that you hadn't associated with the work.
I think when I talk about that translation, like that tension between Fino and like fine and refined, and I think in English, fine it misses a lot of the qualities of fino. And but you know, the process of remaking, as I've been reading, and even and in many of the conversations, you see it a little bit with Valls, you know, when he's speaking, the very older man who's speaking, there's a quality of goodness and generosity, which is part of that definition, which is very, or connotation, denotation, which is very hard to understand alongside something like plasticity, you know? But those tensions, and also a goodness that is not necessarily made, it is not necessarily about performance. When I was looking back at Ortiz and Contrapunteo, the counterpoints of tobacco and sugar, the way in which sort of tobacco is sort of related as something that is about in its wholeness and in its purity without having been processed like sugar and subjected to capitalist endeavors, it is stuck with me. I mean, I think that. The different renditions of the spirituality that emerge from it probably are more than I thought.
Any other questions?
I think Teresita has a question. No.
Besides the film and archiving, and what's the end goal? What do you hope the project will become?
I mean, I'm hoping that that we actually do have something like a 20-minute film that emerges from this, and we have a lot of material, but it will require more work, more filming. I'm wanting to do some more filming in Cuba, and so that's a project that will take some time. I'm also, you know, writing about it. This is part of a longer process of writing, so I'm hoping there'll be some sort of book that maybe looks like a photo essay. Long one, yeah.
Would I be correct in understanding the term, at least partly, as meaning sincere and generous, but on the other hand, hoity-toity?
Yeah, and not necessarily at the same time, though, you know? And that's what's interesting, to have a word that, for someone, like in some interviews, the hoity-toityness never comes up, you know? And others, it's like the central aspect.
How long has this term been used?
As I was saying, it's a word that's been used like among, it's not just a Cuban term, so it's been used among Spanish speakers, from Spain as well. So,
in this way.
Well, since I have like evidence, I mean, from the colony, from the time of the colony and the experience of the encounter of the Spaniards and the...
I mean, but what did that mean then? Did it mean refined? Or, I mean...
That's a good question, and in some of my, you know, reading, I'm coming to that. But I think that a lot of what I come to is, you know, through, you know, cultural readings of it. So, I mean, in a film like The Last Supper from Tomás Gutiérrez Alea from 1974, it's the encounter between the slaves and the masters, and the way in which, you know, what is fino is associated with their imposition of a certain kind of, you know, European culture and mode of comportment. That's intentions clearly with very, very splintered, you know, legacies from different countries of Africa. The word is actually, the film is from 1974, but it's thinking about, you know, the end of the 18th century. So and it's supposedly based on a historical event. It's a great question, and it's certainly one that will require more archival research, and this is actually a project that's not too long. I mean, I have been involved with not that long, so it's certainly a dimension that I want to continue to think about. Do you have any ideas?
It just seems to me that, you know, it partakes at least somewhat of the generosity of taking away another person's culture.
Of taking away.
Taking away.
Yeah, and I think that there's there's these moments like when, and it's something that I've also been thinking about, where Maria Antonia is talking about, like, in socialist society, you know, this whole discussion around the gift, you know, the gift that used to be given by the family, that is given by the government as an act of finesa, in a way, you know? And there is also that sort of taking away that takes part in the act of generosity. So I think that's very...
But it puts people in their place to, you know, to receive.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you.
I have one question. Do you, in Bourdieu's distinction, there's a little category of people who can give value to something that has no value other than through their cultural authority and cultural capital. They can take a poor, you know, poor item from a flea market and actually make it into the coolest thing. And that's sort of one of the highest forms of distinction you can give to something because you have fully endowed it. It has nothing in itself. Would that kind of operation be at all available to the fino or no?
In contemporary Cuba?
Yeah. In a culture that actually does, in fact, recycle and, you know. Are fino objects...
You mean if the notions of fino are built upon or... People build their own notions of, you know, through selecting certain...
If there's an agent, if there's like a category of person, si hay una categoría de persona que podría ser esa categoría de persona que puede como por a través de, no sé, acciones o dichos.
It might be irrelevant for this, you know, it might be an irrelevant translation for one culture and context.
No.
But can the tray that you showed, for example, the tray that, you know, the guy goes, look at this, can that tray become fino through the... cultural capital that the person gives it and makes it into a fino object because they have that cultural capital and they can expend it on this object and elevate it, in fact? Or is that an operation that, you know?
I think that, yes. I think that that's intrinsic to any society. And, of course, in Cuba now people are doing that. But you have to have at least some cultural capital to... create more cultural capital and being able to pick up some objects and I don't think I'm understanding your question very well. For instance, you were talking about the flea market, and that's something I annotated when Jackie was reading. I had the experience last year when I went to Cuba, and I had friends and family there, and I've been going to restaurants and nightclubs and bars, and whenever I go with somebody that is been living in Cuba and doesn't go outside and doesn't have that cultural capital that allows them to identify vintage as something that adds you cultural capital, they don't like those places that are appearing now in Cuba decorated as in the 50s or backwards. They've been living for 50 years in an antique shop. So they want whatever is new or fino for them has to be new and has to be separated from anything that's antique or older than 2000. And even if I've been to places that are really ugly, but they're new, and that's fino now. So.
Yeah, that's why there's a time. I also wanted to, you know, you mentioned the name phenotype in the beginning, and I was brainstorming, going crazy, and Susanna over here said, oh, phenotype, like this, just. And we went through the spelling. Should it be phenotype or should it be phenotype? And we, you know, decided together that phenotype was definitely the best.
Any final questions? Or are we still on for the little time
sure.
before as well?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck with your project.
project.
Thank
it's
you
like
so
really
much.
Cool. And I don't know if this, I've been doing a project in Cuba, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to give you my book because it's
That's
related.
Awesome. Fantastic.
But
thank
anyway,
you.
Thank you. It was really
a pleasure
so
to meet
much.
You. Thank you.
Simone's my name.
Jacqueline.
Nice to meet
pleasure.
You.
Awesome.